Welcome back to the Dungeon Master's Block, the place where we come to talk about the Dungeon Master, the most important person in the game. With every conversation, we hope to inspire as many as possible to keep on Dungeon Mastering.
I'm one of your hosts, DM Neil, aka Joke Maniac, and today DM Chris and I are going to have the absolute privilege of talking to none other than Robert Aducci, who is by far one of the penultimate sources of knowledge about our topic, and that is none other than the setting of Dark Sun. So definitely grab as much sunscreen as one can and get ready for this episode where we dive not too deep, but just deep enough to let you know what Dark Sun has to offer and whether or not you want to add elements or wholesale, just play in that setting for your game. Also, for everyone on the Patreon, you have all voted once again, and instead of written format, there will be some new audio content, a couple of games that I've played that I'm going to go ahead and take. Some have been heard, some have not. I'm going to edit those down, add some background, add some sound effects, and start releasing those on Patreon. There are a couple of campaigns, and basically I'll release the intro to both of them, and then we'll decide from there which one you want to hear. But with that out of the way, let's head to the meat.
I'm starving. We ain't had nothing but maggoty bread for 3 stinking days.
Why can't we have some meat?
Looks like meat's back on the menu, boys.
So today, as our guest, we have Robert Aducci, and this is 2 in a row. It is someone I have actually met in person, which is, again, rare for the podcast, so I'm just trying to go through them all. A lifelong game master, Emmy award-winning freelance designer, professional GM, TTRPG social media extraordinaire, as well as one of the former community managers for D&D Adventurers League. Robert, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Neil. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So as always, I got to talk to you for quite some time on the cruise. But for our listeners that maybe you haven't crossed into their realm, what are some things you could tell our listeners about you that they think that you think that they would be interested in?
Like you said, I'm a designer. I've written a bunch of adventures, primarily adventures for companies, ranging from Wizards of the Coast to Paizo to Schwab Entertainment, Modifius, bunch of folks. And I've just been, a game master pretty much my entire life. Well, adult life, I guess, teenage and adult life. That kind of turned into doing social media in the early 2010s. That's what got me into doing stuff for Adventurers League. And that's what got me into kind of pro GMing. And then now I just kind of do it all.
This is just a curiosity question. It's not in our outline, but I'm curious, like, what keeps bringing you back to the table? I mean, there's so many people that like do it for a season and then stop, or, so many different reasons. But like, what is it for you that makes you want to keep doing this, even to the level of doing it professionally?
I just like to see what happens at the table. I always have an idea of the adventure or whatever, but I'm always amazed at how I get thrown all the time by players. It was really evident when I was doing Adventurers League and I had a specific adventure that I would run multiple times. And so I had run an adventure that I literally ran probably 100 times or so. And so, there's usually 50% of the groups kind of do, what they're supposed to do, or just what was imagined initially. And then some smaller percentages, just do other weird things throughout the games. And I just remember one of them at Winter Fantasy, someone broke a staff of the Magi.
Oh.
And it was just like, whoa, this has never happened before. And so I had to think about what was going to happen. Yeah. As a result of that. And so that's the kind of thing I love. It's just the surprise of what happens.
Yeah, it is true. You can run the same thing multiple times and you could run it with the same group, and depending on how their roles go, the outcome can be completely different, which is super fun.
I also love that that answer is someone else's counter answer of why they never want to do this ever again. I mean, just because it is a very particular person that would enjoy that kind of thing, and there are definitely people that would not enjoy the flip side of that, and the countering all their expectations and how uncomfortable that could make someone feel. So I love that. I love that answer.
I think that would not have been my answer in, you know, when I was in high school. I distinctly remember trying to play a Shadowrun game, and my friends, the party was supposed to like go into this building, this high rise, and they were supposed to like go up to the top and fight the like the CEO. So I thought it was going to be this huge fight, like all the way going up. However, they went in, and then somebody pulled the fire alarm, and I was like, oh. Oh, like what do what I do happens? Now? Like I had no idea what to do then. Yeah, I was stuck. So but you know, I think just over the years I've come to embrace that.
The anarchy, the chaos, all the fun things.
Yeah.
So what else are you currently working on that you can talk to us about? The joy of NDAs and all.
Yeah. So I recently turned over a Fallout 2D20 adventure. So that was pretty cool. That was fun to write. And I'm currently running, I'm actually converted the Ashes of Athis, which is a Dark Sun campaign that was from 4th edition, kind of converting it to 5th edition. So I'm running a group through that right now. I'm writing some stuff for Planescape when it comes out, hopefully to put some stuff on the DM's Guild. Excited for that to come out. I actually just talked to Tony DiCerlisi, the Planescape artist, on my Dark Sun podcast.
Planescape. I am very excited. I am cautiously optimistic. Let's just say those words paired together. Because I have crazy fond memories of that whole thing. So I'm just like, I don't even, I feel like I'm trying to avoid spoilers for a movie that I really want to go see. And I'm like, no, I don't want to know. I don't want to know.
It's like anytime there's like a remake, it's like, oh, please don't, please, like, it better be like, make it better yeah. or as good. Like, don't ruin my core memory.
Right.
So I feel like, Chris, you've already taken our surprise question right in the middle. So I think we should just jump right into the topic at hand. And before we jumped on air, I had mentioned that basically I did very little research about Dark Sun. That way I can take my own preconceived notions and I can just bring them to this conversation and we can kind of talk about it.
And we can see how wrong Neil is.
Oh, gosh. That's not what I wanted out of this conversation, but hey, I'm good with it either way. So can you give us a brief description, like overview of Dark Sun and why it's kind of a unique setting compared to what, I mean, in many ways, I would say traditional air quote fantasy settings are.
Yeah. So Dark Sun came out in 1991. It was one of the later settings of second edition D&D and originally was supposed to be, you know, this desert world. Well, actually, you know, they hadn't even thought of it as desert first. First, they just really wanted a world where, like, Frank Frazetta's people, like all the things that he drew, could be. Mm-hmm. And so that's why, you know, everyone in Dark Sun is half naked, because it's a desert world. And so that's sort of where a lot of that started. And then they wanted it to be something different than regular D&D, the tropes of D&D. And so originally they were going to like not include any of the known races. They were going to kind of make other stuff up. However, someone at TSR at the time was like, well, no, let's dial that back a little. You got to keep the core races, but you can change them. And so they sort of flipped everything on their head a bit. So dwarves are mostly hairless. They are still sort of, you know, kind of focused on, you know, smithing and money and things like that, but they are more focused. They actually have an ability called focus on whatever singular task they want to be doing, which is, obviously, that was cool. And then like elves, they don't, you know, they don't live in forests. There's not really very many forests on Dark Sun or on Athis. They are now like kind of free-willing tribal people that will, you know, they could be raiders. Any elf tribe you run into could be raiders, could be merchants, could be herders, you never know. And then halflings, of course, are like little cannibals, not really cannibals because they don't eat their own people, but they'll eat anybody else. And then you have some new races like Thrykreen, the insect people, and then half giants. And so all of these kind of different creatures live in this world where it's a desert. And from the original box set, you don't really know why. And that's what I really love about Dark Sun. There's a lot of just mystery about the history, because the Sorcerer Kings, who rule these seven city-states, are these really powerful wizard psionicists. And that's another thing, is the psionics play a major part in Dark Sun. And so these Sorcerer Kings, they are kind of, they're very tyrannical, and reading is outlawed. So nobody really knows the history like how we got here, basically. In addition to being psionicists, like I said, the Sorcerer Kings and Queens are powerful wizards, and magic in Dark Sun is not like your regular magic. It is called defiling, and it actually drains the life, mostly from plants, but also it can do it from people too, every time you cast a spell. And so it's kind of commonly accepted that the world is a desert now because there were some great wars previously, and you know, there was defiling happening all over the place. And so therefore the world is a desert, because when you defile, the plants just sort of, you know, turn to ash. There's also a lack of metal, and there's never been a reason why, although again, it's kind of assumed that it was sort of like these ancient wars or something like that. But there's never really given a reason why, whether it's like the planet is naturally low on metal or something happened to the metal. But that also gives it that sort of, you know, kind of savage bent to the weapons, because most of them are, you know, either bone, stone, or obsidian instead of metal.
So I have to imagine that, like, I mean, you talked a little bit about the people that you'll find on Athas, but I have to imagine that, like, the typical idea that I have in my head is like the main world of Borderlands, right? Where like everyone is just evil, or at least like maybe not even evil, but just like in it for themselves. Do you find that a lot in the setting of Dark Sun, where like there are tribal groups that are not necessarily evil, but they're like not necessarily willing to play with people that aren't their own for survival and protection means?
Yes and no. So yes, I can totally see that. But no, because like if people are so isolationist, then you don't really have a game, right? If somebody's not going to deal with you, that's not that fun. And also, when I run games, I like players to be heroic. And so I want them to, you know, to want to deal with other people and things like that. And so, again, just, you know, if somebody doesn't want to deal with you, they want to be isolationist, then, you know, that just doesn't seem that fun unless you can, so, you know, break down their reason for being isolationist. Then, you know, then that's cool.
Yeah.
The one thing there's countless things that it makes me think of. But the two things I think of is it makes me think of Mad Max meets D&D. But you know, obviously lacking the cars and certain things like that. But the other one that I have no context for, and it was my first thought, was with Eberron and the mystery behind the Day of Mourning. Oftentimes, you're very close to that. Like the war has happened, the Day of Mourning has happened. Bam, you're playing right now. Everything blew up. Are most settings? I mean, this is just how the world is, and the reasons are lost to history. Or are there people or anyone that knows a time before the desert?
So that depends on when you set your game. Because originally, with the 1991 release, there were also books that went along with it. So Troy Denning and Tim Brown wrote, kind of created Dark Sun. They're two of the co-creators. There's a couple more as well, but they were the kind of primary ones. And so while Tim was doing the role-playing game stuff, Troy was writing books. And so there is a set of five books called The Prism Pentad. The first book, The Verdant Passage, is amazing. Like, if you want to find out what Dark Sun is, read The Verdant Passage. It is, it's got so much, you know, so much description and just so much tone and everything. It's a great book. And as it goes on through the other books, you learn a lot of the history. And while it was cool and while I like learning stuff like that, by the end of the fifth book, it radically, not radically, but fairly, fairly radically alters the campaign setting. You know, it's sort of like just takes you out of it. And, you know, we changed everything. So everything that we said in this book is not true anymore. And that just feels bad, because I like all that stuff. Right. And then so it took a while, though, for the five books to come out. In the meantime, they were kind of releasing a bunch of just great content where they just kind of expanded the world. And when the fifth book came out and everything kind of changed, they released another box set called the revised box set, essentially, is what people call it. And that came out in like 1995. And that kind of takes into account everything that happened in the Prison Pentad, along with a couple extra years later. And so the Prison Pentad ends with these major things happening, but doesn't tell you what happens after that. And so this revised box set tells you sort of what happened after that, which is kind of cool too, but also, like, you know, again, it changes the status quo of what had been for so long.
You see that some with the edition changes of Forgotten Realms, and then where the novels are just like, we need an explanation. Ah, spell plague. Ah, mm-hmm. ah. And do those certain things. And the flip side, of course, is, again, to speaking to Eberron, just in the sense that Keith Baker is like, I know why the morning happened for me in my game. He's like, and I'm not going to say it out loud, because then you're going to just, everyone's just going to think that that's the way it's supposed to be. He's like, but that's not what I did. What I did is made it so that you have to figure that out. That's, you should do those things. He's like, again, my game is this way, and I'm not going to tell you about it. So yeah, it is tough finding that fine line between, like, I'd like to know most things, not everything, but I'd like to know yeah. most things.
Yeah, it's interesting how, like, if you go back and look at, you know, sort of the history of D&D, right? When they first started putting stuff out, everything was really, like, nothing was connected, right? It was just a bunch of random adventures. And then they kind of started putting stuff together. And then, you know, people started releasing their worlds, you know, Greyhawk and whatnot. And so I think kind of things changed from, you know, the 80s. The 90s were really the, you know, the decade of metaplot, you know, amongst Forgotten Realms, Dark Sun, you know, all the White Wolf games, you know, they were huge on metaplot. And so, you know, Dark Sun was, I don't want to know if you want to say a victim, but it, you know, it was part of that. And as time has gone on, you know, we've sort of changed our ideals about some things, and metaplot is one of those. And so the way they dealt with that is, so in third edition, there wasn't really an official release, although the website that I do, Athys.org, kind of was chosen as the official quote unquote website by Wizards of the Coast, because they knew that they weren't going to put out a Dark Sun setting anytime soon. And so they gave us permission to kind of release a Dark Sun setting. And then we ended up doing that and put out, you know, several books, which you guys can go find on the websites, Athys.org. You know, we were following the timeline. So we set it what's called free year 10. So that's like 10 years after the first book starts. And later Paizo did a version that was like 300 years after. And so this came out as like two magazines, a Dungeon magazine and a Dragon magazine, that were set, 300 years into the future. And then with fourth edition, they kind of reset the timeline to right after the major event of the first, you know, the first box set, the first story really that came out for Dark Sun. They sort of set it right there. So it's kind of like they brought it back to sort of the original box set, more or less.
So I know one of the things that was really interesting earlier is people like who kind of come to our podcast, or people who are dungeon masters who kind of create their own worlds, often think about like how magic works, because it's a pretty major part of any sort of D&D setting. Like, world that I've created kind of has its own way of how magic works. Forgotten Realms has it. Like, every setting has a way, if somebody thinks about it, of how magic works. And you had mentioned that in Dark Sun and Athys, it kind of like pulls the magic from the plants and the living forces around it, right? So like, this is kind of how the magic is known. But if everything's gone, I'm curious, like, are there any like unique spells or rituals or magic traditions that people use to kind of either recreate magic or still use magic? If is magic scarce in this world, like, how does that all work in the world of Athys?
Sure. So magic is fairly scarce. Arcane magic is fairly scarce because people sort of accept that magic is what caused the world to be the way it is. And I mean, if you're, you know, if the world's a desert and you're some little farmstead somewhere and someone comes and casts a spell by you and, you know, destroys your farm, you're going to be pissed, right? And so people hate what are called defilers. But there's another side that people, most commoners, don't really recognize, that there is another group of spellcasters called preservers. And they still use the energy of life, but they just do it slower, right? So they take the energy out kind of slower and from a wider area so it doesn't kill the plants. And so in the original box set, the way that was communicated was defilers were sort of a separate class. I mean, they're still wizards, still do everything the same, except they have a faster spell or a faster experience progression than preservers. And so it was just, you know, like if you wanted to be a defiler, you would level faster, essentially. And so that is sort of like one of the main conceits of Dark Sun. And those preservers, there is a group of like underground preservers. They're essentially, you know, now that I think back on it, they're a bunch of revolutionaries and kind of terrorists, because not all of the preservers are like good, right? Just because they cast the preserving magic doesn't mean they're necessarily good, but all of them are also trying to like overthrow the sorcerer king of whatever city they're in. And so they're a cool organization that, you know, players can be a part of or not. And magic is, you know, more than just defiling, because one of the other cool things, spoiler here, that all of the sorcerer kings are actually dragons. So in Dark Sun, there's only one dragon that's called the dragon. But again, one of the kind of campaign secrets is that each of the sorcerer kings is a dragon. And the way they become a dragon, the way you become a dragon is you pair magic and you pair defiling and psionics together. So once you get to be in second edition, it was like, you're supposed to be like 20th level wizard, 20th level psionicist. And then you could cast this dragon magic that is kind of like 10th level magic, essentially. And so you would actually start turning into a dragon. And that doesn't necessarily mean you would literally look like a dragon. Some of the sorcerer kings look, you know, they don't really look like a dragon. They just have, you know, similar abilities, but just look different. And so that was something that's, you know, super cool. And like, it was always meant to be like a high level campaign. So like when one of the other cool things about Dark Sun is that there's no gods. And so in order to kind of keep healing magic in, they threw in the fact that people worship the elements. And so they get magic from the elements. And so if you were a cleric of like, say, fire, and you were a high level psionicist, you could become like an elemental, essentially. And so, you know, they had a couple of things like that. They also had like high level rogues and fighters and things like that, but they weren't like combined with psionics. They were just like, you were like a super rogue or a super fighter. So yeah, that's kind of the magic of Dark Sun.
The other one that I stumbled onto this, and yeah, this goes back to what are the things that Neil remembers incorrectly? I can't remember if it was that it was just, because a lot of campaigns in 5th edition already lean towards starting players out a little bit ahead. I do it because, you know, pretty much starting everybody at 3, because then you kind of all, you know, everyone has their starting things. So you're not just a druid who has aspirations for the moon. You're an actual moon druid.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. Did Dark Sun, is it that people leaned that same direction because of how tough the setting was? Or was it like written in to say, hey, word of advice, start them out a little ahead?
Yeah, so the default was that you would start at 3rd level. You know, it was kind of assumed that 1st and 2nd level characters, you know, die every day kind of thing. So you're just going to start at 3rd to give you a fighting chance. In addition, because your characters grew up on this, you know, horribly difficult planet, they also had inflated stats. So instead of the 3 to 18, you had 5 to 20. If you rolled, like 4d4 plus 4. Or 5d4, however you wanted to do it. And so you had that range for your base stats, but then in addition, you had even more modifiers based on your race. And they could be as high as plus 4. So like half giants had like plus 4 to strength and plus 2 or 3 to constitution. So, you know, you could have a half giant with a 24 strength, which is, let me tell you, ridiculous in second edition.
So this is, oh man, I can't remember, because I did start in second edition, but I played so much third that I started, you know, deleting files in my brain to start replacing them. Sure. But the one that I was wondering is, because it happened in third and I can't remember if it started in second, was level adjustments, depending on the race that you were playing. Was that a thing in Dark Sun?
It was not, but it was a thing that happened in the third edition version. Yeah.
Yeah, just throw it out there for anyone that doesn't know, you're newer to the game. Level adjustments would be where basically you're playing a race, like, let's say species, that's the word that's being used. You're playing a species that is so strong that rather than let you get a class, let's say we're all starting at third and I play a level 2 adjusted creature. Let's say I just play a full giant. Basically, the game is saying, hey, cool, that's great, but you're going to be 2 levels behind everyone. So whereas someone would be, let's say, a level 3 human rogue, I would be at level 1 giant fighter because basically my right. stats and everything. So yeah, I was trying to remember if second edition had level adjustments. It did not.
And there were some crazy ones that you could play level adjust down. Like, it was like basically anything you could play and then level adjust
half
down.
Half dragons, something, anything.
Balor demons.
Yep. It's crazy. Level adjustment 7.
Yeah, right. Were there, so speaking of some of like the modifier adjustments, was some of that based off of or thought about from the perspective of like maybe some of these races have adapted in specific ways? Is that like to the environment or the terrain? Is that where some of that came from? Or was it just more from the standpoint of like, hey, we recognize that this is a deadly campaign, like, so we're just going to bump those up? Is, was there any thought into that or consideration, or was it just kind of the way that it is?
I think they still kind of stuck with the classic reasons of, you know, like elves are more dexterous and dwarves are tougher, so like they just took those and just modified them. So I think it's just the fact that that they were on this planet, and so straight from there, you know, you're gonna have just high level or high ability scores. In addition, everybody, all player characters had what's called a wild talent, which is basically a wild psionic talent. So, you know, not everybody in the world had one, but they were way more common. And psionicists are kind of like the wizards of other worlds, right? So like there's but probably even more common, you know, so they are like, there are psionic schools in each of the seven city states.
I know this is probably not a fair question, but
ooh, I like it already.
If you had to pick like the top thing about like this element of Athas or Dark Sun is what I love the most, what would you say that is for you?
I think the ecological message, right? Like it's still relevant today. You know, in the 90s, we thought we were going to have it figured out, but we don't. And so it's still relevant today. You know, you have these sorcerer kings who are abusing the planet, and they are all powerful. And so they also have defilers that work for them that are sort of like state sanctioned defilers. And so, you know, they are actively,
like lobbyists or something.
Right. They are actively killing the planet. Right. And so that's, you know, they're often a big kind of big bad for the game. And so I think, you know, just that still resonates, I think, is I think that could. So Dark Sun has some issues lately. I'm sure we'll get to talking about that. But like I said, the issue of, you know, ecological disaster is still valid. And I think a lot of people would be into that, you know, if some of these other issues could be solved.
Yeah. I mean, you think, I often think about how growing up as a kid, one of the big things was like, don't use paper. All the forests are going to be gone. It's like, cool. Mm-hmm. We'll use plastic. It's like, well, we filled the ocean with plastic.
Don't use plastic.
And I was like, well, okay, we're not solving the root issue of what we're doing. We're just
Go back to paper straws, but don't destroy destroy the trees.
Yeah. So right. So it's definitely adjustments. But so I think that I have a lot of random thoughts. I think this conversation has definitely helped explain some things in my brain, in the sense that one of the big things I think about, and we can talk more about this, leave it, and then talk about, because you're bringing up other issues with Dark Sun, but a lot of people viewed psionics in a very negative way, because when it was adapted and pulled out of Dark Sun and placed into something else, they're like, oh, it's too powerful. That concept makes so much more sense when you're like, well, yeah, of course it is. All of the characters are more powerful because of the setting. We're literally starting out at 5 to 20 instead of 18 being the max. So it's interesting that in some ways it was just a stronger power base of a setting overall, which I'm sure could definitely draw a lot more people to the setting itself, as having that really powerful character. But at the same time, regardless of that power, you're going to have to fight for every inch that you're going for in the setting.
Yeah, so they were kind of told explicitly to include psionics. And so the psionics handbook came out, you know, I don't know if it was concurrently or if it was just before Dark Sun. And then there's another book called The Will and the Way, which in the world of Athas, they call using psionics like the will, which means like you have the will to create this psionic power. And then the way is like knowing how to do it. And so there's another book called The Will and the Way that has a whole bunch of more psionic powers. And when you look back at second edition, you know, that psionic set, I love it because it has the feeling that it's not spells. It's something different. You use a lot of points, kind of like spell points, but, you know, they're even more varied. So and then there's no levels of psionics. There's just like they're called sciences and devotions. So sciences are kind of like your bigger, more powerful powers. And then devotions were sort of like your weaker powers. And then there were like six different disciplines, which are just like, you know, the schools essentially of psionics. But the thing about psionics was, you know, you cast a spell and it happens. Like you might need to attack them or you might need them to save, but that's how spells work. Well, with psionics, you had to roll every time to see if your psionics worked. And so that did a thing that people end up calling MAD. So it's like multiple ability dependency. So because your sciences or because your powers could be based on any of your stats, then that means you sort of had to like have good stats across the board to be a good psionicist. Or if you didn't, each of the you know, disciplines was kind of more or less keyed to a different stat as well. And so, you know, you probably just wouldn't take powers that were in a certain discipline if you didn't have a stat that was good for that.
And also that reminded me that the other version is called SAD because it's single ability dependent, but
yeah,
SAD and MAD.
Right.
Very brings me back to all the elementary school acronyms we used for things.
Yeah. And then, you know, in third edition, they changed, well, actually in the middle of second edition, they changed to this system that was instead of the psionic system as it was written in the book, they changed it to like a more, a system that was more based on D&D combat. So you had a mental armor class and then you had a mental THACO, which is basically like your bonus to hit. And so it was like more aligned with that. But that sort of took the flavor out to me. We never use that in second edition. And third edition, like with the Psionics Handbook and the expanded Psionics Handbook, they changed it again to sort of be more spell-like. So it became pretty much just spells with a different name. In fact, you literally had powers that were like, just like this spell, but blah, blah, blah. Right. So they were pretty much the same thing.
Yep. That I definitely remember. And I was like, well, that's not as fun. Because it's fun in the flavor sense that these spells are now available to people, but in the terms of the overall sense of it, you know, and it, even lore wise within the Forgotten Realms, the whole point behind it was like when the spell plague happened, traditional magic users couldn't use their magic, whereas psionics continued to function because it's based on, like you said, the will and the way. And as long as a person could figure out the way again, because they would have that will, then they would just go through the literal mental exercise to figure out how to begin casting, rather than be like, oh, the source of magic that I had is just gone and I do not know what right. to do. You can have all the will and all the way and it doesn't change anything. So yeah, I would love to see psionics in fifth. But I get it. It's monumental. That's a big, heavy lift.
Yeah, there are. I mean, there are some like fan created things that you can find out there, though, that you could try and adapt, which are really fun.
Yeah.
So you had alluded to other issues with Dark Sun. What's the top of your mind when I say that?
So Dark Sun did not shy away from the fact that, you know, slavery is part of the setting. And as a result, you know, nowadays that's sort of, you know, even though things like Star Wars, you know, there's slavery in Star Wars, there's, you know, pretty much slavery in basically any popular media, there's some form of slavery. But it's so primary sort of to Dark Sun in general, because like, for example, a big thing is gladiators. So like every city state has a gladiator. Gladiators are a class for Dark Sun. They were a new class. And so, I mean, you can just sort of ignore it, you know, which is pretty much what I do in my games these days. And it really doesn't change the setting that much. But, you know, in order to sort of write something for the public, they would have to either change it or, you know, modify it to be not so in your face, I think, because now we're sort of much more sensitive to, you know, to not being a jerk to people and not sort of like causing trauma just for playing a game or whatever. And so I think, you know, I understand those needs, those desires to sort of make it more palatable for people. And that's not to say I think it would be fine to do that, because anybody that wanted to include more slavery in their games could. It's not like you would be telling someone, no, you can't include this. It's just maybe not there anymore.
Yeah. And having the flavor text of like, knowing it's like these are the things where knowing your group is so important.
Yeah.
And like, is this something that if you have someone who has a background of being trafficked or something like that, like it might not be the thing you want to include
right
in your at your table,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I I understand what you're saying. Yeah, totally.
Right, and especially if you look at it from the sense of, you had mentioned someone jumping ahead 300 years. Like, there's nothing stopping. So, you know, let's write it for 5th edition. Let's jump ahead those 300 years again. The difference between the world and what aspects do or don't happen in the span of 300 years, especially with the base level concept that there are adventurers screwing this place up left, right, and center with the power that they wield, and especially with the... Dragon Kings, Wizard Kings, but they are dragons. Yeah. Dragon, Sorcerer Kings, Dragon but they Kings. Are, yeah, but the idea that all it takes
Dragon
is... King,
there's a book called Dragon Kings that is a Dark Sun book, so yes.
But the idea that you could have an even more desolate setting because they decide to just pop off 1 year and the 7 of them battle it out and you come to find out that there's only 3 left and there's this vie for the seat of the other 4. And like, is that the main conceit of the world now, is this vie for power? There's a lot of ways to do it. I agree. I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it at my table. No, thank you. Never. I totally get that. And I think it's also just a hard setting to also figure out how hard you want to make day-to-day life on someone, because that can definitely be another issue. If I'm going through all the painstaking processes of how are you getting your food each day and how do you not have enough water to subsist your general existence? Are we going down to the minutia of you're only needing to carry X amount because it's that much worse for you? I think those things definitely can become over prevalent as well in a Dark Sun setting.
Yeah, it is ripe for survivalist stuff in some ways, too, it feels like.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I think sometimes people are like, I don't want to play it because I don't want to do survival. Like, I don't want to have to track my food and water, right? And I would still encourage those people to play, because that's only like a small band of the time, right? And then even if you have a water cleric or you have a druid, like, that's going to be mitigated. Like, it's not going to be as hard to survive because now you got a water druid that can create a gallon of water every day. And even though, like, all of the food and water spells are, like, halved, essentially. So, you know, whatever says in Player's Handbook, take half, and that's what the spell actually does. But, you know, up to, like, I don't know what it was in 2nd edition, but in 5th edition, up to, like, level 7 or 8, is kind of where that ends, because then at that point your clerics or your druids can make enough water for everyone, enough food for everyone in the party. So it becomes a really non-issue at that point. At the same time, you know, getting a couple of levels later, travel doesn't become a big issue. So there's no, you know, you can sort of move away from the kind of getting lost in the desert stories. You know, every once in a while they're fun, but like my characters in one campaign that I'm running right now, they're 13th level and their druid has Windwalk. So that allows you in 5th edition to move like 300 feet per round. And so they just haul anywhere they want to go, right? In general. And so, you know, that's just not an issue. So the nature of the game changes.
I'm thinking about there are some people who have created homebrew worlds. There are some people who are looking for a new world to play in or to pick something up. I'm curious, if somebody wanted to plop a setting like Dark Sun into their world or pick up this Dark Sun setting for the first time, what's some advice you would give to a DM? Like, where would be somewhere to start? Are there things kind of delving into homework a little bit, but are there like specific things that you would have people read or think through or watch, like, about Dark Sun to help them kind of get an understanding of the world, how things work, so on and so forth?
Sure. So talking about putting Dark Sun in another world, there's actually an actual play going on right now by the Blue Box RPG Twitch channel, and John put Dark Sun into Greyhawk. So apparently in Greyhawk, there is a place called like the Sea of Dust. And so the Sea of Dust is Dark Sun. And so he's basically, you know, just running it like that, which is interesting. I'm not sure why he did that, because like he says, like, you can't get from the regular world into the Sea of Dust and you can't get out of it either. So it's kind of like a Ravenloft thing going on or whatever. But I thought that was cool. As far as what to read, I would highly recommend the two things that, you know, if you're going to get into Dark Sun, you should read these. The first is the original box set. So that is just the best thing to read, even if you're not playing second edition. Like, you can completely ignore the rules book, although I would suggest reading that too, because it has, you know, it would give you a flavor of kind of the characters that are there, but also the Wanderer's Journal. And this is another reason why I love Dark Sun, is the Wanderer's Journal is kind of like the world book. It tells you about the world, but it is written from this person called the Wanderer. And so it, you know, this Wanderer just goes from city to city, town to town, whatever, and just writes about what he experiences. And so the information you get is incomplete, right? And it's an unreliable narrator, because this isn't the person that necessarily knows what exactly is happening in the world. They just, you know, reporting what they see. So I always love that aspect of it as well. And then the second thing to read is, like I talked about before, The Verdant Passage. That first Prison Pentad book is amazing. Really, all of the Dark Sun books, the novels, are pretty good from the second edition era. People have problems with, you know, there's some canon issues in the Tribe of One series. And then most of the fourth edition books, with the exception of Rob Schwalb's Deathmark, are not that great. But Rob Schwalb's Deathmark is great.
I like it. I think that leads us right into homework. Chris, is there anything, after everything you've heard so far, is there anything like piece of media, comic, actual play, movie, book that comes to mind that you think would help people dip into Dark Sun? Because I have a couple.
Yeah, I mean, I've gotten back into playing Borderlands 3 a little bit, and like that sort of like desert scape, like nothingness there. I think just looking at some, specifically the geography of those places for how you can describe things and how you can help people understand what travel, even ideas for like crazy creatures that'll pop out of the rocks from where you are or something like that, game from that perspective, I think could be really fun and helpful, especially if you love homebrewing things. You can create homebrew creatures or, you know, whatever in the midst of that too. Could be really, really, really fun. So that was kind of the one thing that I had thought about, mostly from like a geographical, ecological monster sort of perspective there.
So my movie that keeps coming to mind, and we can see if I'm right or not, but the one is Reign of Fire. Mm-hmm. Just in the sense that it's a great movie of showing like the population of the Earth is very small. The world is very angry. I mean, it happens to have a ton of dragons instead of very few. But that basic concept of like even fighting for one piece of protected garden so that they can continue to live, I think is like, can speak to a way to look at the world of Dark Sun, because you are kind of battling for each day. That's why, you know, like we said, first and second level characters, they probably don't make it. Let's just start at third.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I like, just because it has the feel to me of Dark Sun, and it's also set in a desert, is Stargate. So, you know, minus all the science fiction stuff, it still feels very, very Dark Sun, because the world that they're on is, you know, ruled by this basically immortal, and, you know, all the people are kind of nothing to them. And so that's sort of, you know, the essence of the setting.
Until you get some characters strong enough to prove they're more than nothing.
Right.
Perfect. Well, the final question we have is certainly, where can people go to find you on the internet and keep apprised of all the things you're doing?
Sure. So I have a Patreon where I write some Dark Sun stuff and talk about the podcast and things like that. So you can find that at patreon.com/Robert-Aducci. And then there's athis.org, which is the website that I've been with for, I think I started in like 1997 or 1998. So it's been there. And then, of course, the Facebook, there's a Dark Sun group on Facebook that I'm part of that is pretty active. There's a Dark Sun Discord. There's also on athis.org, there's the Arena, which is our forums. So all those places you can chat with me. Oh, and also recently moved to athis.org is the podcast Bone, Stone, and Obsidian. So if you like, you know, we've interviewed a lot of people that had to do with Dark Sun, you know, from the founders to artists.
It's crazy to think that we're in the age of the internet where athis.org is older than a ton of people that play D&D.
Yeah. Sure.
that's a weird place to be in with the internet. Yeah.
Just conceptually, I always like to frame it in, it can legally drink. That website, right. can legally drink right now. Like, it's about to get a price cut on insurance for a rental vehicle. That's the last threshold you get as an adult. You hit 25, your insurance on a rental car, then you just get older.
Yep.
Until you hit 55 or wherever that mark is, and the whole world becomes 10% off.
Well, then it's like, yeah, then it's like collecting Social Security. That's when we'll be in like the old age.
Yeah, there's a 30-year gap between mm-hmm. cheaper insurance and Social Security. That's it.
But someday, it might be like Dark Sun, where there is no Social Security anymore, right?
Seems like we're headed in that direction.
There we go. Yeah, there we go. Full circle.
And on that perfect note, Robert, I thank you for coming on and sharing us
about
Dark Sun, and we'll have to figure out something else. I mean, I'm of the mind that at some point I think we need a whole podcast on psionics. So we'll do that.
All right. Well, thank you for having me. It's been fun.
We just want to thank Robert again for coming on, spending some time with us, telling us about Dark Sun. And I know for myself, I will, as always, look back into psionics and ultimately maybe add it to a game. If you liked what you heard here, you can always head over to iTunes or Apple Podcasts, your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a rating and review. It is super helpful for us. And as always, well, you can find us on social media, whatever it may be called. If it's Twitter, if it's X, if it's Threads, if it's something in between, look up DMS_block. And if you don't find us, look up Dungeon Masters Block, and hopefully we're there. And as always, if we're not, let us know. If it's Blue Sky, we don't have an invite, but hey, maybe neither do you. And as always, the Dungeon Masters Block is a proud member of the Block Party Podcast Network, where you can check out other shows like Dungeons and Dragons and Daughters, who is starting to record their second campaign. So definitely head over, check them out. It's a perfect opportunity to jump on board an absolutely amazing podcast. And as always, thank you for listening to the Dungeon Master's Block, the place where we come to talk about the Dungeon Master, the most important person in the game, the only person capable of playing gods, killing characters, and lowering the ego of everyone else at the table. I'm your host, DM Neil. Good night, good luck, and keep on dungeon mastering.